when it misfired, I just had the feeling that there was more to my life. And from there, really, this was the point that I found Jesus.
Everybody, Doc Brian here, and welcome to Doc Talks. We talk about people's troubles, trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs in life. Today, again, we're recording in LifeWord Studios. They produce content in over 150 languages to 127 countries to a potential listening audience of 2 billion people. As you may know, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and so we wanted to talk about some very specific mental health things. And so today I have with me our guest, Corey Howard. Corey, it's good to have you with us here today.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, so Corey and I have been known in each other probably a little over a year now. Yeah. And Corey, about 10 years ago, attempted suicide. And so we want to talk about that today. And I know that's a very sensitive subject for some people. But I believe if we don't talk about it, then we can't really come to a resolution to help other people in those situations. So tell us a little bit about your life as it led up to that suicide attempt.
As it led up, so I'm originally born in Las Vegas, Nevada. I moved to Arkansas in 2012, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I had an opportunity to come out here and learn a trade. So I did. And my childhood was good. It wasn't a bad childhood by any means. I've heard of much worse stories. But what led up to it the most was that I was in a new state. Yes, I had family here, but I wasn't very close to that family. I didn't have a lot of friends. So just feeling very lonely.
Yeah. So you could say your support structure was no longer there that you had built in Las Vegas. Did you say Las Vegas?
Yes.
Yeah. So in you know, as men, a lot of times we don't like to think that we need other people to rely on, but we do. You know, we weren't meant to be made to be alone.
No.
So how did that, because I'm sure it wasn't something that you just moved and the first day you were here, you realized you didn't have any structure. It was something that kind of led into that. Do you remember one thing that happened that caused you to really realize that you didn't have the support that you needed here?
Yeah, it was. So I moved here and I lived with my dad and I was learning from him. And he wasn't around a lot when I was a kid. I saw him every other weekend. And I think in my early teens, he moved to Florida. So I didn't see him a lot. And then when I moved here, I don't know, I guess maybe I thought we would rebuild our father-son relationship, you know, just have a awesome relationship. And turns out that wasn't it. Working together and living together, we just fought and fought and fought. Mm. We'd fight at work, then we'd bring it home and fight there.
Yeah, it's difficult to be pushed into a situation where there wasn't that father-son bond and all of a sudden expected to be there, you know, this type of seniority level that he would have over you. And so yeah. I could imagine. About how old were you at that point?
I was 10, 14. I was 21.
Okay. So you're still becoming an adult and getting into what that felt like. Exactly. You know, everybody in school wants to be an adult until you become an adult.
And yeah.
Then you wish it'd been differently. So working with your dad, learning a new trade, being in a new place in life and living in a different place, how did you get to the point of where did you ever resolve with your father in those issues, or did you move out, or what happened there?
I ended up moving out after I met my wife, girlfriend at the time. Yeah, I met her, and we quickly hit it off, and one day, me and my dad had this huge blow up, and I quit the company. And I think the next day, loaded all my stuff up and moved to Hot Springs, where she was at. So no, it's very unresolved. Yeah. I think we take the approach of, tuck it away and forget about it.
Mm-hmm. Which is very unhealthy to do.
It's very unhealthy, and it that affects me still to today.
Mm-hmm. Is he still living?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he lives about 30 minutes from here.
Okay. So moving to Hot Springs, tell me about that transition, because now you've hit it off with a girl. You probably think everything's going to be great from here because I've got this to rely on. So tell me about that transition.
So it was great. So I met her, I think, a couple months after my suicide attempt. I moved to Hot Springs, and it was great. She's got two kids at the time. They were 8 and 12, and the older one I actually adopted. And it was a struggle at first because I didn't have a job, but one night I told her, I said, I want to pray together, and let's just pray that I can go out and find a job quickly. And the next day I was hired on at a heat and air company, literally just a mile from our house.
Yeah.
And it was perfect.
It's great.
And it wasn't a great company or anything, but it was an income, to get us by and started.
Right. So let's back up to the suicide attempt. What happened in the days or the hours that led up to that attempt?
So I'm not exactly sure of that, just because there's still some repressed memory of it. I've had some stuff come back, but I just know it was around the holidays. I believe it was in between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Okay.
When I did it, I can't give you an exact date, but it was in that window.
Okay. Can you tell us about how you attempted suicide? Do you feel comfortable with that?
Yeah. I mean, if you're okay with kind of graphic details,
we can put a warning on the podcast.
Okay. But yeah, the way I tried to kill myself was shoot myself. I had a 1911 45 loaded with hollow points, and I pulled the gun or I pulled the trigger on the gun, and it misfired.
How did you feel in that moment? Do you remember when it misfired?
I was crying a lot. I felt very sad, but when it misfired, you hear the stories of, where it misfires and then they reload and do it again. I didn't have that feeling. I just had the feeling that there was more to my life. And from there, really, this was the point that I found Jesus. I'd always known about him, but I wouldn't say I was atheist or a believer. I was just in between, never went to church growing up. And so this is where I found him. And from that point, I put the gun down, and I just started Googling churches and calling their phone numbers.
And did you get a response from any of them?
I did. You're going to hate this, but it was it was the Mormon church.
Yeah.
I bet I called a dozen churches and left messages, and they were the first and only ones to call me back.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it seems like churches are ill-equipped to handle those sort of things. So with a gun misfiring, it almost gave you this thought process that maybe there is something here for me to do.
Exactly.
Maybe there is something to live for. My brother-in-law, whose name was Corey, committed suicide, and his gun misfired, but he did reload and died by suicide. So there are those stories that happen where they do reload and they do move forward with it. Do you remember the immediate thought? Was there almost relief when it misfired, or was there anger? What kind of emotion was expressed then?
There was relief. I can't say on here exactly what I said, but there was relief and like a, what am I doing?
So it was a moment of awakening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a moment of weakness. And when it didn't happen, I had that huge awakening.
Yeah, so I believe, and I don't think everybody always agrees with this, but people who attempt or die by suicide are in an altered state of mind. They are doing things that they otherwise wouldn't have done. They have had depression or anxiety that has gone on for a period of time that they may even be in some state of psychosis, that in that moment they do things that they wouldn't normally do. We hear about, I know pastors, there was a pastor's wife in South Carolina 2 weeks ago that died by suicide. Yep. And so being wealthy or being Christian or being religious has no bearing on any of that. So once this church did reach out to you, what happened then?
So they sent a couple of their missionaries over, and I talked with them, and I think they invited me to church the next Sunday, and I went with them.
Okay.
And there wasn't, you know, any type of special word that was said during a sermon or anything. Mm-hmm. It was more or less just me wanting to learn about the Bible and Jesus.
Yeah. So at what point during that did you find Christ?
I believe right in that moment when the gun misfired, because I knew there had to be a greater power that stopped this from happening.
Yeah. And that greater power cared enough about you.
Exactly.
To allow it to be stopped.
He knew I had a purpose for this world, and he wasn't going to let me end it prematurely.
Yeah. Yeah, so how did your family respond? When they found out, or do they know?
They don't know.
Okay.
They'll find out if they ever listen to this podcast, but I've never, I think my dad, mom, I think maybe my sister, I have a twin sister, maybe she knows, but my wife knows.
Yeah. So to ask a very cliche therapist question, them not knowing, how does that make you feel?
I feel like they should know, especially since it's been so long since it happened. But I also know my family and how they would respond. So, like, my mother, she'd be very, very sad, and my dad would basically just call me stupid for doing it. So I think I'd try to save my mother the heartbreak, and I just don't want to hear it from my dad.
So protect your mother, but also protect your mental health from your father.
Exactly.
Yeah. So moving forward for that, how did you begin to grow? How did you begin to come out of that depressive state?
So I came out of it, like I told you, I met my wife very quickly on after that. I can't give you an exact window, but it was pretty quick. And I was telling myself, I said, maybe this is what I'm meant for. She had two kids with dads who are not good dads at all. They're awful. And I said, well, maybe I need to come into their life and teach them how a father is supposed to be, teach them how a woman should be treated from a man, because they've witnessed bad things happen.
Yeah. And so stepping into that role, because from what I understand, you really didn't have that father who, you know, laid out to you how to be a father. How did you navigate through those waters?
Here's a simple way that I looked at it. It's going to sound awful, but I did the opposite of what my parents did.
Yeah, it doesn't sound awful. If you had a bad if you had a bad experience, then do it exactly the opposite. But I mean, it's I can say that I wasn't given a very good example of what a father should be. But that was kind of my motto, is that I'm going to be just the opposite. But I really didn't know what that fatherhood looked like until I became a father. Yeah. You know, we have this idea about what it should look like. So how is it different than moving into a home with three kids? So I'm sure that has to be a little bit of a overwhelming for you.
Yeah, it was two kids.
Okay, two kids.
Yeah, two kids. It was overwhelming. Like my son specifically, he always loved to come into his mother's bathroom in the morning when she would get ready, and mm-hmm. then I come in the house, and he's still doing it. I'm like, yeah. Okay, this needs to stop happening because I'm in here getting dressed, mm-hmm. and the kids are amazing. They weren't ever that difficult. Yeah, they had a teenager phase, mm-hmm. but they are really awesome kids. Yeah. My son was a little hard sometimes because he had some ADHD, mm-hmm. But all it was that he had a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. So it was really fun being able to come in there, you know, and get to play with him all the sports, the baseball, the football, get to go to all of his games. Mm-hmm. And then my daughter was 12, so coming into teenager. And you know how kind of difficult that could be at that age. Mm-hmm. But I just went in there with a calm mind, never any yelling, mm-hmm. and just try to talk through things with her.
Mm-hmm. So your then girlfriend, I assume, how did she respond when she found out that you had attempted suicide? Or was it after you got married that you shared that with her?
I shared it with her very early on, and she was, sorry, my nose is itching.
You're fine.
And she was very sad, and, you know, she cried, and, you know, wish I would have called her at the point. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe I didn't tell her everything, because after Man Alive, mm-hmm. it was last year, mm-hmm. I think when I went and met you, mm-hmm. I, you know, you can't explain what Man Alive is. You can't explain it. But I tried the best I could and was talking about, you know, sharing your life story. And she goes, well, I don't think I've ever heard your life story. And I said, well, you have, but I don't think you know quite all the details. Mm-hmm. And so one day we sat out back and I told it to her.
And how did she respond to that?
She took it very well. Wasn't sad or angry or anything. I think trying to put the right word in my mouth. It wasn't sad or angry. She just she understood, and now that she knew all the details, and I told her, I said, you're one of the things that saved my life because you and these kids gave me purpose to my life.
So how important would you say purpose is in somebody's life?
For a man, it's everything. Mm. We have to have some purpose in this life.
Yeah. So when we look for purpose, in your opinion, where do we find it?
We find it with those closest to us, our family and our jobs. Popular question when two men get together, oh, what do you do? Mm-hmm. What do you do?
Yeah.
They want to know how I make my money. Whenever I get asked that question, mm-hmm. say, what do I do? Yeah. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I'm a Christian.
Yeah. Yeah, I hate that question.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like they're asking to have a qualifier of whether or not you're worthy.
Exactly.
To be talked to. And you know, we learned through Man Alive that that's a pose, mm-hmm. and we don't have to, you know, step into that. And I hate when people ask me what I do because I'm not even really sure what it is that I do.
you have a bunch of titles.
Yeah, so it's very difficult. So I know that for me, when my brother-in-law committed suicide, my first thoughts were, what could have possibly been so bad that was the only way out? Now, with my brother-in-law, I knew some things that were going on. My sister had just filed for divorce. They had just had a baby. The baby was not doing well. He was drunk one day and went up and tried to kidnap my nephew from the hospital, who was in an incubator. Ended up in jail overnight and got out and committed suicide. And his suicide letter, he said that he was a very angry individual and that he had hurt his son and he was going to make sure that it never happened again. as a family member to that, it hurt my heart to think that it was so bad that he seen that there was no hope. There was no other way. Mm-hmm. In your suicide attempt, again, the lack of the community, the lack of purpose, were you convinced that there was no hope for you to ever have purpose? Or were you just in that moment of where you didn't have purpose, so there was no reason to live?
It was a mixture of both. In my mind, I couldn't see any purpose of my life. Yeah. I couldn't see into the future at all. Yeah. And at the time, also having none. So I just knew there was nothing here for me. Mm-hmm. And I was dead sober, wasn't drinking. I didn't leave a note. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have to explain it to anyone. I just wanted them to bury me and be done. Mm-hmm. And there was just nothing. At the time, you just think there's nothing for you here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've shared with our group before that I never had a suicidal attempt, but I had some suicidal ideologies. And my thought process was, I'm not ever going to be good enough. You know, it wasn't that I didn't have purpose. It was that I wasn't ever going to be good enough. And I think sometimes we get so weighted down by those things. Even somebody asks you, what do you do for a living? And you don't think you're good enough, you know. And we just kind of shrug it off, well, I do this or I do that, that we feel like there's no purpose even in our work, let alone in our lives. Now, 10 years post-attempt, recently you had a friend who died by suicide, a really good friend. And can you in the best way that you can possible, because I know it has to be very emotional for you. Mm-hmm. But the moment that you found out, what was your first thoughts? What were your first emotions in that?
My first emotion was that I was angry beyond belief because it was being hidden from me, mm-hmm. that it had happened. And you're probably going to be angry the way that I found out. Mm-hmm. So he died. I was actually working the day that he died, and I tried to call him for some help, and he didn't answer. And I was like, that's weird. He always answers my phone calls. And it was the next day that I found out, and what it was a mutual friend of ours had called me and said, what happened to such and such? Mm-hmm. I texted her back. I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And she goes, he killed himself. Mm-hmm. And a meeting had been called for the news to be told to us in person about what had happened. But I immediately called that person, the person who was going to give us the news, and I basically told him, he's one of my best friends. Why didn't you tell me? Mm-hmm. Why didn't anyone tell me? But it was the family's wishes to kind of not keep it hidden, but just wait till everyone was together to give us the news. It got easier once I realized, okay, I've got to respect what the family wants, and this is what they wanted.
Yeah, that doesn't always mean it's the right way to handle things, especially if it's, you know, a day later.
Yeah.
But as somebody who has walked through that, it's incredibly difficult for the family to grasp what happened. And a lot of times the details are very hazy. You know, you have to make a lot of assumptions about what took place. And so it's difficult, but I'm not them, and I don't know what they wanted, but as somebody who's been through it, somebody who has had friends who have committed suicide, the earlier that you tell somebody, the better off it is. Yeah. Cause they probably weren't hiding anything, but it makes you feel like there was something not being told.
Yeah.
So, So walking through that, when you did find out, you were angry at them for not telling, but how did you feel toward your friend?
I felt sad for him because, I guess, a little bit of angry too, because there were some times there late at night, in the middle of the night, that he would call me, and I knew at the time I was talking him down from a ledge. I didn't know what that ledge was. But at the time, I just wished he would have called me. Mm-hmm. I wished he would have taken just a second and hit my name on his phone. Mm-hmm. But I can see, here's the thing that I can relate with this more than anyone else can. The way that he killed himself is exactly the way I tried to kill myself. So I know what was going through his mind to a T. And at that point, he just didn't want to be saved.
Yeah, there comes that point of where there is no hope, and you're convinced there's no hope beyond, and so they intentionally do not call because they know that you're able to talk them off of that ledge. And so it's not that they didn't reach out. It's that they didn't want to know or try to be convinced otherwise because they believed that there was no hope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if he would have just, it was like midday on a Saturday, if he would have just made that phone call, I could have said, man, come to my house and I'll have 30 men here waiting for you to all talk to you.
Yeah. But even that's a scary thing.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in that moment, and that's, again, that's why community is so difficult. You know, the group that we are a part of, there are about 30 men that would show up, but we know them well enough that we can say whatever we're going through and they'll take it to the grave.
Yeah.
You know, that there is that trust there. Mm-hmm. But so many people don't have that. And you know, as a pastor for years, I searched for that because, you know, you really shouldn't be that open and transparent to some people in your church because then you could lose your job.
Yeah.
You know, but there comes that balance of how do we share when we don't have anybody? And as you said before, if you go to your parents, you know, they may respond in anger, you know, that's stupid, you shouldn't think about that. Or they may respond by going into a depression themselves that they have failed. And so it's very difficult in those times to try to figure out what and how we need to do and where to be honest. And so many times it ends up that they don't have a group or they have somebody that knows they'll talk them out of it. Yeah. So they just go ahead and do it.
I think that's where the suicide hotline would really come into play. It's totally anonymous. You can text or call.
Right.
And I say that I didn't take that advice. I didn't call them. But between that and the normal community, you know, if you see someone that's having a tough time or they even come to you and say, hey, something's wrong, just listen to them.
Yeah. And there, you know, there are a couple of things. Of course, you mentioned the National Suicide Helpline. You can call or text 988. Yep. 24 hours a day, there's somebody there. Or if you are in immediate harm, call 911 and get help. But there are those around us that somebody says something and then they think, well, they're just trying to get attention. Suicide is not something where you should assume anything.
Exactly.
There is a thing called a no harm agreement. And that's where you go to your friend and they say, have had suicidal thoughts or ideologies, or I want to die. Now, if they're saying they want to die and they have the means to do it, you need to get them to the hospital. Mm-hmm. But if they are just having a suicidal ideology and they've not developed a plan, then that's where you can give a no-harm agreement. And what that is, it's an actual contract that you write out in hand that says, I, in their name, promise I will not harm myself before I see you again at a date and a time. And then you sign that. And about 98% of people who sign a no-harm agreement will not break it because they feel that's one thing that they have, that they know they've got to stick around for because they love you enough or they love whoever had them do that agreement, that they're going to wait until that time. If somebody had reached out to you and offered you a no-harm agreement, do you think that would have changed your attempt?
Definitely. Because it would have been nice to at least have someone to listen to me.
Yeah.
And have someone to continue to talk to about stuff.
So do you think there were some signs or symptoms that maybe even your friend displayed that could have led you to believe that this was a possibility?
Yeah, there was one time that he had called me, and it was in the middle of the work day, and man, we must have talked for 2.5 hours. That was literally, I think, 4 days before he killed himself. He was telling me how life is and how it isn't good right now, and I gave him advice that he thought was very sound advice, and he said he was going to do it. There was also, you know, there's a sign where your friends or loved one who are planning to commit suicide, they tend to give their stuff away. Well, there was one day there where it wasn't anything personal to him, but it was just like some parts for work that he had given me that I thought was really strange. Like, why are you giving me these? But okay, I'll take them.
Yeah.
I'll use them one day.
Yeah, that is a sign, especially if they start giving away things that are very personal to them.
And usually another sign is they make these grand, big plans for their life. And his plan was he was enrolling back in college. And he's going to become the big boss one day, and I'm going to be his right-hand man. And I'm like, man, don't do that to me. I don't want to be a boss. But I would do it for him. And so, yeah, there's that sign of making these big plans that you seem are kind of impossible.
Yeah. Another sign is somebody who has been in a depressive state or somebody who's just always have a low mood, all of a sudden one day they're extremely happy.
Yep. He had that too.
Yeah, and that's because they've resolved that I'm finally going to not hurt anymore, or I'm finally not going to hurt anybody anymore, and I'm happy that there's this foreseeable way out.
Yeah.
So in the after the days go by and after the funeral, where does that leave you?
It leaves me lonely and sad because we work together, and he was always my go-to with the problem or I just need to vent, and I was his. And I've caught myself so many times calling him, and I'm like, he's not there.
Yeah.
So I haven't really found that person yet to call. Sometimes I just make random phone calls to guys that I work with, but really I want him.
Yeah. And that will, you know, in the stages of grief, that's part of it, is that while we intellectually know that he's not there, our emotions want us to believe that he is, that this is some big dream that we're going to wake up from and everything's going to be back to normal.
Yeah. In the stages of grief, it's not like you go through step A and move on to B and C. Man, they come and go. I still experience anger here and there.
Yeah.
I just get randomly angry for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not a progressive set, and you can be in more than one stage at the same time. You know, they just bounce back and forth. So as somebody who is a survivor, and that's the way I like to put it. And somebody who has lived through a friend committing suicide, what would your message to the world be?
My message to the world is, if you've dealt with any kind of mental issues or drug abuse, alcohol abuse, addictions, porn addictions, if you have dealt with that and lived through it, and have overcome it, you have something. You have something greater than most people on this earth have, is that you've overcome an addiction and an illness. You have something. And if you're there with mental illness and you're so deep that you don't see any way out, call someone. Call someone that you trust. And if you don't have someone to trust, text or call 988.
Yeah. There's a thing that circulates through social media, and it's kind of cliche, but it says, I would rather listen to you at 3 o'clock in the morning tell me all your problems than to hear about your life for 20 minutes at a funeral.
Exactly.
And your life really does matter.
It does.
As bad as you may think it doesn't, your life really does matter.
Yeah.
Corey, thank you for being on our podcast today and being vulnerable enough to share your story and your hurts. I really appreciate you being here.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So as we mentioned on the podcast, if you or somebody that you love are suffering from suicidal thoughts or ideations or even an active attempt, you'd reach out to the National Suicide Helpline by texting or calling 988. If you fear that someone is in immediate danger, please call 911. Remember, you do matter. Your life matters. You do have value. You do have purpose. So we hope that you will stick around. Get help. It's okay. Have a great day.